This morning, in this part of Focus 580, we will be talking about the relationship that developed over the course of World War II between Franklin Roosevelt and Winston Churchill. This is the subject of a newly published book by John Meacham, our guest. He's the managing editor of Newsweek, and the book is titled Franklin and Winston, An Intimate Portrait of an Epic Friendship. Random House is the publisher. This book is out now in bookstores if you want to take a look at it. And, of course, your questions and comments are welcome on this show as we talk. All we ask is that people are brief. We ask that so that we can keep the program moving and get in as many different callers as possible, but certainly anyone is welcome to call, be a part of the conversation. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That's good anywhere you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. If you're listening around Illinois and Indiana, you can use that. As a matter of fact, if you're listening on the internet, and as long as you're in the United States, you can use that number. Again, toll-free, 800-222-9455, and here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Mr. Meacham, hello.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Well, thanks very much for talking with us. We appreciate it. Let me ask a question you yourself pose and answer in the introduction to the book, and that is that, you know, so much has been written about these two men. Certainly Winston Churchill himself wrote an awful lot about his own life and his experiences in the war and in government. Why yet another book that deals with the life of FDR and Churchill?
Well, the focus of this is the friendship and the emotional connection between the two men, which had not been done before. And what I wanted to do was really try to figure out how much of their relationship was personal and how much was political. And how, you know, is it possible to separate those two, which is a very, very difficult thing when you're talking about heads of state and heads of government who are thrown together by amazing circumstances. And the other thing is I think that there's a great deal of resonance with what Churchill and Roosevelt faced with what Bush and Blair are doing. Bush and Blair are playing parts first scripted and acted by FDR and Churchill. Blair is clearly following a Churchillian script. Churchill once said his last advice to his last cabinet was never be separated from the Americans. And Bush is trying to become a war president in the mold of a Roosevelt. Not successfully sometimes, but clearly their story, the story of Roosevelt and Churchill, is very much alive in the heads of the people who are leading us now. In fact, when Bush was first inaugurated, he asked for a bust of Churchill to be sent over from the British Embassy to put in the Oval Office. It's just to the right of the fireplace. And one of the things I wanted to do was go inside the Roosevelt-Churchill friendship and also their leadership and try to figure out how much of their leadership was more nuanced, had more to do with diplomacy sometimes than force, than we sometimes remember. I think there's a tendency just to remember the two men as these black and white giants who won a war. That's true, but these guys spent 113 days together. They wrote 2,000 messages back and forth, and they were fierce and intricate negotiators. These were guys who would stay at the table until an issue was solved. And they also founded the international organizations that kept the peace for 60 years. You know, the United Nations came out of their conversations. So I think there's a great deal of resonance for today. And it's also just an amazing story, an amazing human story. I really decided to do it, and the theme of the book crystallized for me when Churchill's last surviving child said to me that whenever she thought of the Prime Minister and FDR, she thought of the French proverb, in love there's always one who kisses and one who offers the cheek. And Papa was always kissing, and President Roosevelt was always turning the cheek. And I think that what I tried to do was reconstruct that emotional minuet.
As you point out, there are apparently, and when we're talking about just the nature of this friendship and how deep it was, as you point out, there are some historians that say that it's been overblown and that, in fact, a lot of that should be laid at the door of Winston Churchill in his memoirs, he talked, apparently wrote a great deal about it. And what he was interested in was strengthening, cementing that relationship between Britain and the United States. Having said all that, how close were these two men? What was the nature of this friendship?
I think it was genuine. And I took as my witness Eleanor Roosevelt, who was one of the most honest women who ever lived to a fault. I mean, this was a woman who could not tell a lie. And she had every political reason and ideological reason in the world to downplay any ties of affection and friendship between her late husband and Churchill in the years after the war, because Churchill was still clinging to the British Empire. They had to pry it out of his cold, dead hands, basically. And, of course, Mrs. Roosevelt was a fierce advocate of the United Nations and of the expansion of human rights and self-determination. And so they didn't agree politically in the years after the war. And yet, again and again and again, in her memoirs, in a book she wrote at the very end of her life, in her private letters, Mrs. Roosevelt said that the friendship between my husband and the Prime Minister was quite genuine, and the affection and the pleasure they took in one another's company made the war easier to win than it would have been without it. And that was pretty powerful testimony, because she would have had every reason to have said, well, it was all convenience, we've dispatched with that enemy, and now Churchill is irrelevant. So that's an important thing. And also just reading these letters, again, there are 2,000 of them, and politicians can fake it for a long time, but you can't fake it over 5 years, 113 days, often voluntarily time spent together. All you have to do to look at a case where a relationship was entirely political is look at Churchill and de Gaulle. They certainly didn't spend that much time together. They didn't have the occasion to exchange that many letters. And basically, Roosevelt and Churchill came from the same class. They both came from the tops of their societies. They loved Shakespeare. They loved bad movies. They loved hymns, high office, strong drink, tobacco, the sound of their own voices. Mary Soames, Churchill's daughter, once told me that sitting between them was like sitting between two lions roaring at the same time. So they enjoyed the idea of themselves on the world stage. They enjoyed being together. And I also think we often think that politicians check their humanity and their emotions at the door of a summit meeting, that history is a more clinical matter, that forces are more important than people. I don't think so. And politicians are, if anything, more emotional and more human than a lot of people, and more subject to the affections and the atmospherics of a moment, because what they're paid to do is read those affections and atmospherics. The best example of where the personal intersected with the political was on a June morning. It was a Sunday in 1942. Churchill had been staying at Hyde Park with FDR, and they had taken the overnight train to the White House. Churchill had finished breakfast, they'd taken a bath, gone across to Roosevelt's study, just as the news came that an important British garrison in North Africa had fallen. And the pain and the anguish and the humiliation, really, on Churchill's face was so striking that Franklin Roosevelt, a notably chilly and distant man, a Machiavellian man, simply looked across the table and said, "What can we do to help?" And the British witnesses in the room were convinced that if the garrison had fallen when Churchill was in London and FDR was in Washington, and if the request for tanks and more aid, which Churchill immediately made while he was standing there, had to go through channels, they wouldn't have gotten it. He asked for 300 Sherman tanks. At that point, we had about 302 in the world, in the American arsenal. And it was a case where, and I think if we all think about our own lives, we can understand this, a case where seeing someone's anguish led to an action. You know, it's the easiest thing in the world to say no by letter. It's a little harder by telephone. And for a lot of people, it's almost impossible to say no face-to-face. And these guys spent an enormous amount of time face-to-face.
Mm. Our guest this morning in this part of Focus 580, John Meacham, managing editor of Newsweek magazine. He's the author of this new book titled Franklin and Winston, an intimate portrait of an epic friendship about the relationship that developed between Franklin Roosevelt and Winston Churchill during World War II. It's published by Random House. And questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. I think it's an interesting exercise to develop these two lists, one a list of ways in of things that the two men had in common, and then set that aside, the other list, which is the ways in which they were different. And it certainly seems that one of the most important ways in which they were different was in terms of their personality, that Churchill did seem to be a more open person, a much more emotional man, a man who did tend more to wear his heart on his sleeve, and that Roosevelt was much the opposite, much more contained, controlled, perhaps manipulative. There's a wonderful quote that you offer in the book that I'm sure is mentioned in every review that is a quote from Harry Truman talking about Roosevelt. Truman said of Roosevelt, "He was the coldest man I ever met. He didn't give a damn personally for me or you or anyone else in the world as far as I could see." Of course, then he does go on to say, but he was a great president. He brought this country into the 20th century.
Right. I think Churchill and Roosevelt, there are two important points here. I think their personal vices were political virtues. Franklin Roosevelt, as you say, was a difficult, elusive, often manipulative man. He controlled the flow of information. He completely compartmentalized his life. You know, from his marriage to his politics. He once said of himself, "I am a juggler. I never let my left hand know what my right hand is doing." That was exactly what we needed in 1939 and 1940 and 1941, when we had 90% of the country not wanting to get involved in another war. Hitler's on the march. We can look back now and self-righteousness in retrospect is easy and say, well, we should have gotten in after Hitler invaded Poland in 39, or how could we have sat out while Britain stood alone in 1940, and why did it take us until not only until we were attacked at Pearl Harbor, but until 4 days later, which is when Germany declared war on us. People forget that we didn't enter the war against Hitler on December 7th and December 8th of 41. We had to wait until he moved first. But we needed that kind of Rooseveltian deft manipulation. And I think what made him a sometimes chilly friend and certainly a difficult husband and not a particularly good father were the qualities that made him a good president. His wife said, I thought rather chillingly, Mrs. Roosevelt once observed, that a man in public life is not husband, father, or friend in the commonly accepted sense of the word, which is a very interesting point. On Churchill's side of things, I think his emotional life was so richly imaginative. And so when Winston Churchill focused on something, he's like a laser beam. And he could be right and he could be wrong. His best friend in British public life, F.E. Smith, once said, "When Winston's right, he's right, and when he's wrong, my God." You know, that was his best friend. I think that Churchill, in 1940, he became prime minister on the 10th of May, when everything hung in the balance, and a different kind of man, a less romantic man, I think, ultimately, probably would have seen the logic of trying to cut some kind of deal with Germany, sanctioning some part of their conquests on the continent, perhaps to rearm and fight another day. But that was the rational thing to do. Well, Winston Churchill was a romantic. He wasn't rational in that way. He thought he was a soldier of Britain, that his destiny was to save the country. And he thought this for 60 years, since he thought his first memory was of the sound of gunfire and martial splendor, a little parade in Ireland where his grandfather was the envoy. And he didn't become prime minister until he was 65. We now remember him as this great, amazing man of the century sort of figure. You know, you wouldn't have found, you could have gotten a phone booth full of the people who thought he was going to succeed even as late as 1937, 38. And I think a lot of that had to do with his emotional makeup in the same way that Roosevelt's did. And the political virtue of Churchill, who could talk too much, who drank too much, who smoked too much, who would run off with an idea and pound it to death. Winston Churchill thought no horse was better than a dead horse. Sometimes, though, and in particularly in 1940, you needed someone who had that kind of steel and that kind of, frankly, irrationality to stand there and say, Hitler will go no farther. It'll be over my dead body. And he meant it. I think he would have died in the streets of London repelling German invaders.
You know, at the time that war officially broke out, was declared between Britain and Germany, Churchill was in Parliament. He was a member of Parliament and was distinguished by having said publicly all these things that you said, taking a very strong stand against making any deal with Hitler and talking about how dangerous Hitler was. And then when one war actually broke out, Neville Chamberlain, who was the prime minister, was compelled to bring Churchill into the cabinet because Churchill at that point was vindicated. Everyone said, right. Well, now Winston was right. And Churchill became the first Lord of the Admiralty, a job that he had had before. And then at that point, because Churchill understood just how important the United States was going to be to Britain's survival, he initiated this relationship with FDR. So this was before Churchill became prime minister and more than 2 years before Pearl Harbor. Did Franklin Roosevelt at that point, do you think, see Churchill becoming prime minister? Did he in his heart somewhere think, now this, I'm going to have to be dealing with this man as the leader of Britain?
He was making it's a great question. He was basically just trying to get any help he could. He was placing bets all over the table. He wrote Churchill on the 11th of September, always a momentous date. As you say, a week after Chamberlain brought him back into the cabinet, saying, "If keep me in touch personally with anything you think I ought to know about. Send me notes through my pouch and I'll answer through yours," which was quite a remarkable thing for a head of state of another country to reach out to a cabinet minister of a second country. Now, Churchill made sure Chamberlain knew about it and kept the ducks in a row there. But Roosevelt had no real sense of this. He'd met Churchill once. They had met on the 29th of July, 1918, at a dinner on a Monday night in London at Gray's Inn. When Roosevelt was Assistant Secretary of the Navy, he was 36. Winston Churchill was 43 and had already been First Lord, fallen from power, gone to fight in the trenches in France, and was then back in the cabinet as Minister of Munitions. And it was a very glamorous dinner. The war ministers of Britain went out of their way to heap praise on this young American visitor, partly because they were so delighted that we'd finally gotten in the war then, which was also late in terms of how long they'd been fighting. And Churchill had not taken a shine to Roosevelt. Roosevelt later told Joe Kennedy, Churchill was the only man in public life who was ever rude to me. He acted like a stinker, lording it all over us. And we also have to remember that Kennedy was writing, who was our ambassador to Britain, was writing letters back to Washington to Roosevelt, offering very dark views of Churchill's future. He wrote in February of 1940 that Churchill has turned into a fine two-fisted drinker, and his judgment is never proven to be too good. So Roosevelt was getting, if anything, negative reports about Churchill. And in fact, on the 10th of May, when Churchill became prime minister, the news came to the White House when Roosevelt was meeting with his cabinet, and the telegram was brought in. And Roosevelt said out loud to his cabinet, you know, a room of 15 people, "Well, I suppose Churchill is the best man England has, even if he is drunk half his time." So this was not a wild vote of endorsement, and it makes sense in that way, because to go back to something we were talking about a second ago, Churchill had bet big on huge public issues and lost. He'd been the architect of the amphibious assault at Gallipoli during the First World War, which had been a disaster. He had been the Sydney Street riots, was blamed for violence against striking miners when he was Home Secretary. He had bet epically wrongly on Edward VIII during the abdication crisis. So Churchill was this figure, sort of this Don Quixote figure in a way, where he would tilt at a windmill and would be absolutely obsessed with it. And things didn't always work out. In fact, by the time we got to 38, 39, 40, things had largely not worked out He was not seen as a particularly strong factor in British public life. But Roosevelt did have a sense that he might be vindicated. Roosevelt saw the rise of the dictators in roughly the same way that Churchill did in the 30s. Roosevelt felt himself constrained by political realities here, and I think when he picked up his pen to write that letter on September 11th of 39, he was just really doing what FDR always did, which was try to keep as many sources reporting directly to him as possible. You know, Roosevelt was famous in his management style to give the same job to two people to see who could get it done faster. He believed in creative tension, I think would be the nice way we would put it, and enjoyed a certain level of chaos around him, and partly because that kept him in control, and he got to hear arguments hashed out. I have a suspicion that he was hoping he would get letters from Churchill that might make a case he would not hear from Chamberlain. So in an interesting way, I think he was treating the British government rather like his cabinet, sort of in the way he would have dealt with Harold Ickes and Harry Hopkins, whom he used to assign the same job to. And Churchill was quite brilliant. He realized that FDR loved sea stories, and so he would send long accounts of the early naval battles, which Roosevelt loved and read. And I think there was, early on at least, for Franklin Roosevelt's letters, there was a note of respect, not quite affection yet, but certainly respect for Churchill's lonely stand in the wilderness. I think FDR admired politicians who endured, even if they endured storms of their own making.
We have a caller to talk with. Let's bring them into the conversation in Urbana, line one. Hello?
Yes. I was interested to find out that both Churchill and Roosevelt were Masons. And I was wondering, just knowing that information, whether that led to, whether they both took that side of their life seriously and whether that enhanced their relationship or whether you know anything about that side of their relationship.
It's a good question. I did not explore that very deeply. It was one of the, it was sort of like a collection of things that was a mark of their membership in a certain class and a certain milieu of society. They were also eighth cousins, if you work back the math. I think it was more important that they had both been high-ranking officers, civilian officers in their navies during the First World War. They had both been intensely interested in the rise of progressivism. Churchill had been a very ardent young liberal, which we sometimes forget. He had been a key figure in David Lloyd George's early governments. And so they shared the same life experiences. They were both shaped by the Boer War on opposite sides. So Roosevelt had been an anti-colonialist, pro-Boer undergraduate at Harvard. Of course, Churchill had fought the Boers in the field. So they had come through the same political battles. They'd been shaped by the same forces, sometimes in different ways. So when they came together finally again in August of 41 at sea, they were roughly of the same generation and had roughly, at least had gone through the same battles, which I think was by and large more important than any particular membership in something else.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, and again, other questions are welcome. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana, toll-free, anywhere you can hear us, 800-222-9455. And again, our guest is John Meacham. He's managing editor of Newsweek and author of the book Franklin and Winston. And it's about the relationship that developed during the course of World War II between Franklin Roosevelt and Winston Churchill. And it's published by Random House. I expect that... like probably many Americans and Britons of their time, that Roosevelt and Churchill would have had ideas about what the other country was like, maybe on the level of stereotype, but they would have some sort of sense. You know, Churchill would have had some sense of what America was and what Americans were like, and FDR would have had the same kind of idea in his head about Britain and what the British were like. Did they, in fact, come to the relationship with that, and over time, do you think they refined, changed that kind of perception to one that was more in line with the way the two countries really were?
It's a terrific question. I do think they came to the table with preconceptions. I think Churchill saw Americans as very strong but very untutored, very rough-edged, and he saw his role and Britain's role as kind of the midwife or the mentor of this rude young power. In fact, when Churchill first came to America, of course his mother was American, as you know, he first came in 1895 and visited New York and wrote a letter home to his brother, Jack, in which he said that Americans were like a boisterous young child among well-educated ladies and gentlemen, very strong but very loud and not particularly well-behaved. And there was another strain which came out, I think, of the First World War, and our, you know, we didn't begin fighting until 1917. Of course, the war began in August 1914. Neville Chamberlain once said, "It is safe to count on the Americans for nothing except words." And that was kind of the British view, that Americans were very self-centered, were very self-absorbed. And Churchill shared that in part, but he also had a very strong sentimental tie to the country, largely because of his mother. And also Winston Churchill admired strength, always admired anyone who had great power to wield. And so he always kept that in the back of his mind. I think that changed as he got to know Roosevelt and America. I think he came to see that we were not as untutored, perhaps, as he had thought on the front end. But he did hope that his role and the country's role, Britain's role, would be to be the agent, be the translator, the buffer between the new world and the old. And that's, again, you see that with Tony Blair now. That's clearly his foreign policy bet. Roosevelt had a very anti-colonialist view of Britain. He thought of most Englishmen as sort of like the father in Mary Poppins, you know, who sang, "It's grand to be an Englishman in 1910, King Edward's on the throne, it's the age of men." There was a strong view that from Roosevelt that the British Empire had not done right by its subjects, that too much of the empire lived in squalor and poverty, and if only they could see the sweet reason of the New Deal and of kind of Roosevelt globalism, then they would be better off as well. So both came to it thinking they were almost morally superior to the other. And I think that changed when Roosevelt sat and watched Churchill hold out and the British people hold out in that long 1940-41 period, when they were under constant aerial attack. You know, nearly 40,000 Londoners died in attacks from the air during the war, which is a phenomenal number when you think about it, civilians. Civilians had become targets, which is another reason, frankly, that I think this book resonates, at least for me, is you have states and semi-states and ideological entities targeting civilians in other countries and trying to find what were, for the moment and the time, unconventional ways to attack them. As the two men spent time together, as I say, these views matured, but at heart, Roosevelt always believed that his best way to needle Churchill, to use FDR's word, which he sometimes wanted to do. He sometimes wanted to tease him and needle him, particularly when Joe Stalin came on the scene, was to make fun of John Bull and the cigars and the empire. He once referred to a stopover he made in South America as "that hellhole of yours." And so he really thought he could bring Churchill along in the way that Churchill thought he could bring Roosevelt along. Mm.
We have another caller in Chicago. Let's talk with them on line four. Hello.
Good morning. I would like to know, two questions, actually. When Roosevelt demanded unconditional surrender of the Germans and the Japanese, didn't this take Winston Churchill a little by surprise?
Well, there's a great debate about that. I don't think so. I sort of walk with Warren Kimball and Michael Beschloss, who went back through this. I think the element of surprise was he might not have expected it to be announced so starkly at that particular moment. It was more a matter of stagecraft than substance. And I think we forget this now, but unconditional surrender was hugely controversial because there was the issue that you would not encourage anti-Hitler Germans to...
Well, that wasn't true, that the anti-Hitler conspiracy or whatever it was.
Yeah, July.
They were talking to the Americans in Switzerland, and they're saying if you'll drop the unconditional surrender, if you'll agree with the government without Hitler, the war could come to an end.
Right. It was in Bern very late in Roosevelt's life. That's true. And it drove Stalin crazy because he thought the Anglo-Americans were negotiating behind his back. So there's the question of whether unconditional surrender prolonged the war. My bet is no. But Churchill, because of that controversy, Churchill's war memoirs have to be read very carefully. They are both advertently and inadvertently revealing. And at that bit, the time he was composing them in the late 40s and early 50s, unconditional surrender was not very popular, so he covered himself a bit by saying that Roosevelt had gotten ahead of him. I think the record does not quite bear that out.
Okay, well, that'll always be a controversy. But another question I was going to ask you, when Eisenhower and Montgomery clashed during the Battle of the Bulge, when Montgomery said some unfortunate remarks about the American Army,
right.
Didn't Eisenhower want to relieve him, and he thought he couldn't be relieved, but they said that, well, Roosevelt, well, Marshall will go to Roosevelt, and Roosevelt will go to Churchill and demand it, and it'll happen. Is that true?
That is true. And of course, it ultimately didn't. But there was no question. That was a huge moment. You put your finger on something. And it happened nearly a year earlier. It was, or more than a year earlier, in August of 43. I think if you wanted to ever pinpoint a moment where the mantle of global responsibility really moved from London to Washington, it would be in August of 43 at Hyde Park when Churchill and Roosevelt were driving around the woods up at the President's estate, and Roosevelt prevailed on Churchill to name an American as the Supreme Commander.
Well, I think Montgomery wanted that position for himself.
Well, Montgomery wanted it, but the more likely British candidate, and in fact Churchill had offered it to him twice, was Allenbrooke. Who was the George Marshall of England? You know, was the chief of the. I love this title, the chief of the Imperial General Staff. That's a title I'd like. But Allenbrooke had to then be told he could not do it, and Roosevelt then had to decide, as you know, between Eisenhower and Marshall, and ultimately came down for Eisenhower. But there was no question, particularly December 44 and into 45, into Roosevelt's death, that if the British had pushed command and control questions past where Eisenhower wanted them, Eisenhower would have gone to Roosevelt, and I think Roosevelt would have made
happy. He would have told Churchill, he would have insisted that Montgomery be relieved.
Yeah.
And in fact, I've heard that in the telegram that they didn't send, they actually suggested Montgomery's replacement as either Field Marshal Brooke or General Alexander, one of the others.
Yep, you're right. You're right.
Okay,
right.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
All right, let's go to Champaign County for another caller here, line one. Hello.
Hi. I think you mentioned Roosevelt's, you know, sense of his own power, and I think the commonalities are more there than one would think. The teasing that you referred to with talking about the hellhole in Latin America, that had to be British Honduras, and that was the only enclave that Britain had in our backyard. So the teasing might have been a little bit differently than you might think of just teasing anti-colonialism. After all, Roosevelt's the author of the earlier remark in the, I guess it would have been the late 30s, where he said about Somoza that he's a son of a bitch, but he's our son of a bitch. So
right.
That's an acknowledgement of de facto, you know, Monroe Doctrine hegemony over our sphere, basically. So.
Oh, I completely agree with you. Roosevelt hated the idea of an empire unless he was in charge of it. That's absolutely right. There's no question that Roosevelt had an idea of having really an American empire, or at least an American order, maybe that's a better way to put it, in place after the war. The United Nations would be the instrument of it. He actually talked on his the last few days of his life, to those adoring women who are always around him, he mentioned out loud, perhaps I should resign and become what he called the moderator of the United Nations. And he had an idea in his head that he would move up to Hyde Park, and Harry Hopkins would teach at Vassar nearby, and they'd build a landing strip, and the world leaders would come and land there, and he would solve their problems, and they would take off and fly away. This was not a man without an enormous measure of self-confidence. And why not? I mean, here's a man who really overcame what is almost unimaginable to me anyway, to be 39 years old in the prime of life and wake up one morning and realize you can't walk. And then to go on and be elected president of the United States four times, outstripping the great hero of his youth, Theodore Roosevelt. So I understand why he was so self-confident. He had every reason to be.
Well, I think also, if you might let me in here, that you might also grant him some kind of sort of liberal motive for arranging the world Pax Americanus. And I think that buys into the idea that, he had mixed motives, even about the New Deal, I think. I think the New Deal was an upwelling from below that he had to, had to cooperate with to the extent that he had to. I just don't buy the complete unalloyed kind of portrait that he often gets, even from people that are denigrating him. I just think it's much more complicated than the idea that he was frank about, wanting to moderate the Pax Americanus after the war. I think that undercuts any kind of real sense of America's role for democracy, et cetera, et cetera. I'm a skeptic on that entirely. After all, he wasn't calling Somoza a son of a bitch for no good reason. I mean, it was acceptable for that to be the case.
I agree with you up to a point. I think that. I agree with you, the New Deal is much more complicated. The idea that he is an unnuanced liberal icon is wrong. I call him in the book a practical idealist. I think that he, rather like JFK in a way, he was uncomfortable with utopian left-wing rhetoric because he didn't think it sounded tough. And he always wanted to be seen as a tough, practical man. And I think Harry Hopkins shared that. But he also had an extraordinary passion, when you think about it, for a man coming from where he came from in life, passion for the lot of the common person, as did Churchill. And we're better off because even if he had attitudes about race and about economics and about democracy and human rights that we would not, that would grate on our ears now, he is the man who, with Churchill, kept the experiment in democracy alive. And it was right there on the cusp. We forget this. I mean, the wars between capitalism, totalitarianism, and communism, that's what the Second World War was about. And in this only Adolf Hitler could somehow or another get communism and capitalism together to beat him. But that's what happened. And it really was Roosevelt, I think. I think that when you look at the alternatives in 1940, Wilkie was a Republican internationalist, but the Republican Party had an interesting orientation toward the Pacific in those days. And I think it's possible that you would have had much more interest in the war against Japan than in the war against Hitler if Roosevelt had lost that third term, and we might not have done what little we did for Britain in 41, which was Lend-Lease, which wasn't decisive, but at least linked our interests in such a way that the British knew at some point, to use Churchill's phrase, in God's good time, we would get there and help them.
Well, there's so many complexities here. The whole, it was under Roosevelt that we shipped pig steel to Japan while they were rampaging in Manchuria and China. So, I mean, this was something that also was acceptable for a while in the stories of cooperation at high levels of corporate interests between the U.S. and Nazis are also important in the lead-up to all this. But I just think that Churchill was also very unallied. You did say he was, clinging to the empire, but this came out of his experiences in the 30s, where he was, calling the Arabs niggers and gassing them in Iraq. He was involved in the subjugation of Iraq, actually, so many years ago, and he was a creature of his times, you can say, but there were people criticizing at the time, too. Thanks a lot.
All right. We have about 5 minutes left in this part of Focus 580, and our guest is John Meacham. He's the author of a new book that looks at the relationship between Roosevelt, Franklin Roosevelt, and Winston Churchill in World War II. The book is titled Franklin and Winston, and we just have a little bit of time here left. There's so many things that we could touch on if we had another hour. One thing I was interested in having you talk a little bit about was how did Churchill think about Roosevelt's disability?
He would fiercely admired Roosevelt's courage, and he sensed it from afar, which is an interesting point. I'm glad you asked that. Churchill wrote a profile of Roosevelt in 1934, long before the war, long before they came back together. And he wrote it for Collier's. Churchill had the situation where, as his daughter once said, they lived from article to article and book to book. He had that wonderful situation, which apparently only British aristocrats have, of being immensely rich but never having any money. So he wrote and fed himself with his pen. And he said, I'm paraphrasing, but roughly, not one man in 10,000 could have, with their lower limbs refusing their office, rejoined life. And not one man in 10 millions could have joined public life and risen to the top. And he so admired Roosevelt's courage in fighting polio. And then I think one of the most touching moments in the relationship came when they had a church parade together on the HMS Prince of Wales in August of 41. And Roosevelt was determined not to ride in his wheelchair across the deck of a British warship that had been in combat. And as you may remember, the way Roosevelt walked, in quotation marks, was to snap his braces shut and have a man on one side of him and a cane on the other, and basically just will himself forward in a way that if he had fallen, he would only have been able to break his fall with his arms. Mm-hmm. He would have fallen like a dead weight. But he walked, and he used to call it stumping sometimes. He just went bang, bang, bang across that deck. And one of the British observers in real time wrote that what struck him seeing Roosevelt's courage as he made this long, long walk for him was an image of St. George slaying the dragon. And they were so moved by his attempt to pay respect to them. Churchill shed a tear as he watched it happen. And it was actually after that morning that, of which Churchill said, every word seemed to stir the heart. It was a great hour to live. And they'd sung some classic old Protestant hymns. And Roosevelt turned to his son afterward and said, "Onward, Christian soldiers. We are Christian soldiers, and we will go on with God's help."
As you mentioned earlier, the two men exchanged a great many letters and actually met personally more than 100 times, and you have to imagine just how difficult that was, first of all because there was a war going on, and secondly because Trent, getting from one side of the Atlantic to the other in those days was not as easy as it is today. So they spent a lot of time together, and they exchanged a lot of letters. In the course of this relationship, was there a lot of conversation about personal matters? Did they talk about their wives, strong women both, or their children, or what was going on in their lives other than the war?
Absolutely, they did. In fact, the marriage is all intersected. Eleanor and Clementine would spend time together. They talked about their children. Their children were almost all in uniform, which is something we forget. So they had children under fire. And they also had children who, how to put this charitably, were rather a handful. Randolph Churchill was a formidable person, sort of like what Lionel Trilling once said of Jane Austen's Fanny Brice, an evening with Randolph would not be undertaken lightly. There's actually a wonderful letter I found that I think I'm the first person to use from Bill Walton, who a war correspondent, later a friend of John Kennedy's, who had run across, who had come to the White House and had a moment with FDR before he went to Europe. And FDR asked him, because Walton knew some of the Churchill children, asked after the Churchill children, and Walton's observation was, FDR seemed delighted because Winston had so many problem children of his own to deal with. So they would sit and talk about this. They would talk about the burdens of command. They would complain about the press. They would complain about their opponents in the House of Commons and in Congress. And they really were, this brings us full circle, this was the most exclusive of clubs. No one else on earth could understand what the other was going through except the other. The heads of the English-speaking democracies, to whom this incredible task fell at the hour of freedom's maximum danger, and who else were they going to talk to about hating, you know, a newspaper column that was always second-guessing them, or congressmen who didn't seem to understand the enormity of the issue? And they talked to each other, and nothing ever leaked, remarkably. Not one of these 2,000 letters ever inadvertently leaked, which is almost impossible to imagine today. I would hope that we at Newsweek would be getting some of them if it were happening. So they really, they were like two young soldiers in a way, encamped together.
We're going to have to stop. We've just used our time. For people who want to read more, of course, you look for the book Franklin and Winston, published by Random House, by our guest John Meacham. He is the managing editor of Newsweek. And Mr. Meacham, thanks very much for talking with us.
I'm very grateful.